Where we left off last week. So first things first, we'll make sure we're recording. Linda, if you're recording, that's good. I'm gonna record as well. Test, okay. I'm recording. So, now that we're recording, next on the agenda is to do the preliminary homage. So scroll back up to the top, and we start with Arahang Samma, and we'll just say it together. You can say it in English if you like, or in Pali if you like. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadim Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namam. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Okay. Now we scroll back down to where it says we are here. And we're starting with the words tasmātiha bhikkhave. Just a second. Okay. Tasmātiha bhikkhave. So just to recap, we have we've gone through two parts, two sections. First is the opening section where the Buddha proclaims all of these aspects of existence to be non-self. And then he goes on to argue as to, in detail as to why, in the second section, why they should be seen as non-self, why they should not be seen as self. So here we have a third and a fourth section, which we're probably just going to lump together because there's not a terrible amount to talk about. And these detail the course of action, right? What is the conclusion? The result of seeing, no? Well, first the the duty for us to see them in this way, and then the result of seeing them in this way. This kind of gets back to actually how the Buddha taught the first sutta. Remember, in the first sutta, the Buddha said there is the satchanyana, kichanyana, and katanyana. For each of the four noble truths, there's the truth, the noble truth, and the fact that it is the truth. Then there is the what should be done. And then there is the knowledge that it has been done, or the result of it having been done. So, satchanyana is referring to the first, really the first sections. It's outlining the fact that it is the truth. And now in the section we're coming up to next, it's going to talk about what should be done. Kichanyana, that which should be done. And in the final section, it's going to say katan. It's going to talk about katanyana, what happens when one has done what needs to be done. So again, the important point to keep in mind throughout all of this is that we're dealing with a theory of reality that doesn't involve entities or a three-dimensional universe, space-time. All of that is derived properties of experience. Our experience of things creates the universe. So he's talking about how the mind relates to these experiences, and how one should direct the mind to relate properly to these experiences. In that sense, he's not really, as I've said before, he's not really saying there is no self, there is a self, because those statements imply existence of entities, right? If you say there is no self, then you're implying a framework within a self could exist, but the entire framework doesn't exist. So, or the way of looking at reality is totally different. Doesn't allow for even those statements. We have to think of reality in if we're following the Buddha's teaching, we have to think of reality in a practical sense. Reality as being intrinsically practical, having to do with our practice or our deeds or experience and interactions and reactions. So we shouldn't read more into it here and say, oh, the Buddha taught this or that, or start wondering about what happened to myself. And, well, then who is, if there is no self, then who is it that acts and so on? Because all of these, this really is totally unrelated to what the Buddha is talking. It's a whole different way of looking at the universe. And the idea is to try to get ourselves to looking at the universe from a point of view of right here and now. And so our study of these texts should actually be practical. We should be meditating here. All of us sitting here should be engaging in the practice of meditation. You shouldn't have 10 tabs open in your browser and instant messenger and an email client open and so on. I have my email client open because people keep sending us requests to join. But that's the only reason. we should be engaged, we should be immersed in this. Especially this next part, because now he's going to detail how we put into practice these important truths. So what does he say? Well, first of all, before I start, just to make it clear to those who haven't heard, you're welcome to butt in and ask questions whenever you like, and I'll try to pause and answer questions. And often that's what keeps us here for hours and hours. So if you want us to stay or stick around, if you are really interested in this and in learning stuff about the Buddha's teaching, please do ask questions. Otherwise, I'll just plow through it. And we'll try to make it as meditative as possible. If you don't have questions and you're pretty clear on the Buddha's teaching, you can just use this as a meditation practice. When you hear my voice, say to yourself, hearing, hearing, and focus on the sound. And you'll see the truth of what the Buddha is saying here very clearly. So the Buddha says, for the reasons given above, tasma, which means from that, meaning from what he said before, yang kinchi rupang aditang aditana gatapachupanang. So, and then he's going to list all sorts of rupa, and then all sorts of vedana, and then all sorts of sanya, all sorts of sankara, and all sorts of vinyana. Basically, you can lump this all together, and what he's trying to say is all rupa, all of the five aggregates, wherever they occur. So you can just understand it that way as opposed to breaking it up into pieces, and that the Buddha's just using rhetoric here. You could understand it that way, but I think each of these deserves some attention, and it allows us to pause and reflect on the sorts of things we're talking about. Because there are three levels on which we have to come to understand this. First, we have to gain the right view. We have to get it through our minds that this is the case. So some of it can be even intellectual, right? Because not exactly intellectual, but extrapolating based on our practice. For example, we practice here in the present time. But the Buddha is asking us to see all rupa in the past and in the future, and even those far away, as being not self. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. And so this takes a little bit of reflection, or it takes extrapolation. In fact, for a meditator, it really actually doesn't. The extrapolation is automatic, because the mind doesn't have to work intellectually. When you experience just one thing as being impermanent, unsatisfying, uncontrollable, the mind automatically accepts that as reality. There's no need for you to experience any other thing as being impermanent, unsatisfying, and non-self. The mind is just released. It lets go of this kind of phenomenon. At that moment, the mind lets go. The mind gives up its attachment to arisen phenomenon, because it sees that when something arises, it ceases. And so you don't have to actually go back to the past and go ahead to the future. But it does happen on different levels, because there arises the right understanding based on intellectual thought, which encourages people to come to practice meditation. Because if people think that something in the future is going to be controllable and self and so on, if they don't understand the uncontrollability of life, many people in the world do not, and are thus blocked from practicing meditation. If you don't, it will be very difficult to progress. It's very difficult to even get interested in meditation, if you don't see the uncontrollable nature of reality, the fact that it's not yours and not amenable to your wishes and desires. So this is why people who are sick and have experienced some loss or some terrible catastrophe, why they are attracted to meditation. It's not exactly because of the suffering, but it's because they can't control. Right? Because if suffering were controllable, then you wouldn't worry about it. And so for the most part, we're deluded into thinking that suffering is controllable. Linda, are you recording here? Because my recording's not working. Go figure. I wonder why that is. Okay. Try again next week. Okay, thank you for recording. So there's this view that has to be obtained, or has to come to one, this idea of non-self. It one doesn't even think about it, and it doesn't come from studying or so on, but it's the reason why many people come to practice meditation. They have some uncontrollable suffering, uncontrollable problem. They can't solve it. The old ways of solving things don't work. So they've tried medication, they've tried therapy, they've tried whatever they've tried. Maybe they've tried drugs, maybe they've tried entertainment, and they find that nothing satisfies, nothing kills the pain. And so they try meditation. They may not actually have come yet to the realization of uncontrollability, but that's what they have to come through. If it doesn't come through, it doesn't come from outside experiences, then in meditation they will come to realize that we have to, in order to deal with the suffering, we have to change the way we look at it. We have to stop rebelling against it. And this change comes from seeing that we are not the masters of these things. We're not the masters of rupa, of our form. We're not the masters of our feelings. We're not the masters of our memories and thoughts. We're not the masters even of our own consciousness. As I said, as we talked about last week, we can't even control the things that we become conscious of. So one thing that's really great about the way the Buddha puts this here, past, future, he's just cutting down any exception. And it really makes it quite graphic that there's nowhere to hide, there's nowhere that the self can hide. No, none of these things should be understood to be self. And this really sets the tone for meditation, right? Because he's really driving the point home that nothing, and that everything should be seen as it is, as something that arises and ceases. Even talking this way, even before you practice meditation, really does set the tone. It doesn't mean that you should go into meditation and when something arises say, that's not self, that's not me, that's not mine, or push yourself. But it frees you up from the concept that, oh, now I'm feeling this, oh, now I'm feeling that. Like many meditators will come and when their mind is going crazy, they say, oh, my mind is going crazy, or I'm having a breakdown. Someone said recently, told me that she was having a meltdown. This kind of wording, when a meditator tells you, I'm having a meltdown, it's a sign that there's still the attachment to self, because it's identifying with the experiences and creating an entity out of them. Right? First of all, the I, then the meltdown. Right? What is a meltdown? Well, it's just the five aggregates all rolled up into some chaotic jumble. And so when you come into the meditation equipped with this knowledge and this warning of the Buddhas, or the instruction of the Buddha, then you'll be able to you'll automatically focus on things as being what they are, arising. Okay, this is a feeling, this is that. Especially how he lays it out, because one thing that he's kind of just slipping in here is this whole idea of the five aggregates. I mean, as far as I know, it wouldn't have been terribly familiar to these guys. Now, maybe it would have been, but it may very well be that they weren't familiar with the five aggregates, or they didn't look at reality as being just these five aggregates, because apparently that's something that the Buddha did, something very clever of the Buddha, brilliant, enlightened of the Buddha, to be able to break. I think Sariputta was the one who said the Buddha has done something very difficult in breaking reality up into the five aggregates. The Buddha is not explaining the khandhas because these ascetics already understood them. Thus, they understood the nama-rupa process. I don't quite get the question. It's framed a bit not like a question, actually. You have to make it clearer what the question is. No, and sorry, I think I'm just talking exactly about what you're talking about. The ascetics wouldn't have heard of the five aggregates. So this is something new that he's helping them with, because they're already practicing meditation for sure, but he's helping them along to be able to break it up, and so that they're able to come to this realization of seeing things arising and ceasing. Now, as Sotapanna, they would have already done this to some extent, but I think it's clear the profundity of this sutta, how it's really driving this home and really clarifying the nature of reality for them. And it does for all of us. This is one thing, he doesn't make clear in this sutta, is that he's not just talking about non-self, he's actually for the first time detailing these five khandhas. Both in the first sutta he mentioned them, but in this sutta, he's really, really given them the treatment. Yeah, now I get it. The Buddha is speaking directly to the five aggregates. He has not begun by explaining them. And I think this is what I'm saying, is that he's just slipping it in there. Because it would be clear to him as he says it, what he's talking about. Like when he says rupa, they know what rupa is, but now they understand, oh, rupa is really one of the building blocks of reality, and then vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. So without giving them any instruction, or maybe he did, it may have been that between the first sutta and the second sutta he actually did talk and explain these five things, but at any rate he's not doing that for us. But we should pick up on this. And what it's implying is that this is all there is. This is reality. Right? Because he doesn't give a sixth thing and he says, and say that that may or they, that may, he doesn't even talk about anything else. And the reason he doesn't talk about anything else is because that's all there is. This is the framework of reality. Or it's one framework of reality. Another one is the six senses. If you want to think of reality as in terms of the six senses, you can do it that way. But the truth is that we'll do that actually in the next sutta. The next sutta looks at reality in terms of the six senses. But what you'll see is that actually the six senses is only the five aggregates, understood in a different way. The five aggregates arise at seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and to some extent thinking. So they really are one and the same, but it's a different way of looking at it. And the reason for using different ways of looking at it, we can talk about that in the next sutta, but different people have different inclinations, and actually has to do with how different people cling to self. So I don't know that we have to go in and explain all of these. Maybe I can just briefly go through them and we'll see if there's any that are confusing. Okay, so everything in the past, in the future, and in the present, all rupa, all of the form means all of our memories of form, and all of our expectations of how form should be in the future, and vedana and sanya and sankara, vijnana, all of our experiences that we've had in the past and all of them we have in the future, they're all just like they are here, and the ones that are here and everywhere else are not self. Anjatang means, this is an interesting one, it could either mean ours and someone else's, which is probably correct here, but it can also mean based on the six senses of an internal sense and an external sense, or it can mean both the mental and the physical. Internal could be mental and external could be physical. But here it probably just means yours and mine. So both the ones that are internal to you and the ones you see in other people. Other people's rupa is also the same. Other people's vedana and so on. Olari kangwa. So even the coarse, the gross form or gross feelings. Because, this is an important one because many, many meditators will fall into this distinction between gross and subtle, and they will be enchanted by the subtle rupa, subtle vedana, subtle experiences. So they'll have refined experiences of peace and calm, and they will think that now that they've gotten rid of the coarse ones, now they've found something stable, and this experience is stable, they think, just because it's more subtle. This is very common for meditators when they've been practicing intensively for a few days. They might begin to see lights, colors, pictures. They might experience great peace and calm. They might experience happiness. They might experience knowledge and wisdom. They might experience great energy or clarity of mind, mindfulness, faith. They might experience great faith and confidence, and so on. And they will cling to these subtle experiences. It's very difficult to, and it takes time sometimes. I have one meditator right now who has some sort of experience like this, and the key really is to be clear that it's not really a big deal, and to not put emphasis on it, to not make a big deal out of it. Once you show the meditator that it's really, that you're not really interested in it, then they'll lose interest in it as well, as they experience it again and again, and eventually realize that it's not really doing anything for them. And you have to remind them indirectly not to cling to things and not to see anything as me or mine, and so on. Until they get it for themselves and they see that it's not me and it's not mine. It's funny, he's got them in a different order. I wonder if the Pali's in a different order. Gross ajitangwa sukumangwa hinangwa. Or else he. Let me see. Gross or subtle. Yeah, it's in a different order. Inferior or superior. Now that's the same as subtle or gross, I suppose. Or you could think of it as being in this realm, or in the heaven realms, or in the animal realms, or in the hell realms. Or it can be ones that we like and ones that we don't like. Whatever is nearby us and what is far away means in the entire universe. All of these astronomers and astronauts going off to explore the far reaches of the universe, like Star Trek, no? The last frontier, the final frontier. And there's a story that goes along with this, of the Buddha was once visited by an angel, and the angel said to him, "Look, the reason I'm an angel is because I was practicing as an ascetic and I had magical powers. And I thought I would try to find the end of the universe." So he thought of this, the final frontier, space, the final frontier. And so he zoomed out into outer space. And for 100 years he flew through the cosmos. And he still didn't find the end of the universe. And so he died and was reborn as an angel. I think the Buddha here is referring to right understanding in the sense of an insight knowledge, not in the sense of conceptual knowledge. Is that right? That's right, I haven't gotten to that part. That's a good point. So the whole idea that it should be an intellectual understanding, but it should be an intellectual understanding in the beginning. What he's giving them now is an intellectual understanding, a conceptual knowledge. So you, as I said, this is important going into the meditation. And even during the meditation, because they're meditating right here as the Buddha's talking. And he's coaching them through it, and he's giving them this intellectual framework with which to approach the meditation, which is going to allow them to see with wisdom as it is, which is very clearly a meditative understanding. Of course, that's the most important, but I did want to point out that the intellectual framework allows you to approach the practice in the right way, as does all of the Buddha's teaching. Okay, so this has to do with this angel. So the Buddha says to him, "Yeah, I know. I tried myself." He said, "I did the same thing when I was an ascetic. One birth, I tried flying through the cosmos. Must be something that magic-powered ascetics undertake quite frequently, one would think. You know, got nothing else to do, let's go see what the end of the universe looks like." And then they realize that it doesn't end. And he said, "But the end of the universe is not found in that way. The end of the universe is found in this 6-foot frame." I forget how it goes. Atabawe. Maybe Atabawe. I can't remember. Anyway, in this being, in this form, in this 6-foot by 2-foot by 1-foot frame, is where you find the beginning and the end of the universe. So, dure santikewa, whether it's far away or close by, it's all just Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. This is, I had a lot of fun talking with a Hindu, and this Hindu meditator in Los Angeles. And she was really nice. We're still good friends. But she would always come at me with all these crazy Hindu experiences that she had, and all these magical experiences, crazy things, she said. Like, kind of makes me think that she might be schizophrenic or something. But you know, if it's all real, it's quite incredible to hear. Now, of course, it might not all be real. It might just be in her mind. Of course, the problem is it's hard to tell the difference, really. But she would tell me all these things about how I experienced this and I experienced that, and I would say, well, and she, what does Buddha say? What does Buddhism say about that? Well, Buddhism says that it's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. And so eventually, I would just say that to her. I would just say, yeah, it's all still just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. And it really helps to limit arguments. And it really is a philosophy that is all encompassing. It's phenomenology, I believe, is radical phenomenology or something. You have an answer for everything. If someone starts talking to you about God and they said, "I saw God," right? And you say, "Well, then that's seeing. You saw God. That's an experience of seeing." And maybe that I felt the love of God. Well, that's feeling. And also the matter of explaining to people that when you feel God, the feeling is true. The feeling is real. The truth of what you're saying exists in the fact that you felt something. But whether or not it's God is completely up for debate. So being able to separate people's experiences and people's claims in this way really allows you to point out the difference between reality and concept. So anyway, saying that all of this is non-self. Then we get to the part that I think points to John's question. At the end of all this, when he talks about, when he's done talking, done explaining all the different kinds of aggregates that are non-self, he says, what about this? He said, eva metang yatha bhutang samma panyaya. Dattabang. Dattabang means should be seen. Datta comes from the verb, the root dersh, which is to see. And this is, I think, a little bit important because the Buddha uses the word see in these types of context when he's talking about direct realization. So he's obviously not encouraging them to think about it. He's not encouraging them to do any intellectual reflection. He's encouraging them to look, right? Because if you want to see something, you have to look. And where are you going to look? You have to look at these five things. I don't know if I mentioned it before, but actually the five aggregates are just the four foundations of mindfulness. So if anyone's a little bit confused about what we're talking about, or how this relates, how can we practice this? Well, if you've ever heard of the four foundations of mindfulness, it's really just the five aggregates. It's just a different package. It's maybe a little bit more palatable for people and a little easier to understand based on the way it's packaged. But it's really the same thing. So if you're practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, you're also practicing to see the five aggregates. And you're also practicing vipassana. Vipassana, passana, means to see, means seeing. It's the same word as dattabang, and this is something we learned in Sanskrit, that in the present tense they use pas, but in other tenses they use dersh, something like that. But in Pali it doesn't quite work that way. In fact, I'm not even sure about what I just said about Sanskrit, but if I remember correctly, that's what the Sanskrit teacher told us. But there's two verbs in Pali, dasati and pasati. Dasati to see, pasati to see, I believe. I'm not a Pali scholar. But Dattabang and it comes from the same, it's the same idea as Pasati and Passana. So this is where the Buddha, people always say the word Vipassana isn't used very often in the Tipitaka, but this is really a fairly narrow-minded statement, because the Buddha uses the word to see in this figurative sense all over the place. Here he's talking about Vipassana. How do we know this is Vipassana? If we look at this word, sammapanyaya. Samma means right. Panyaya. Panyaya means with wisdom. So the panyaya here is replacing the prefix vi. Vi in vipassana. Vi means clearly or specially, or in this case with wisdom. So panyaya dattabang means to see with wisdom, which means vipassana. It's this exactly the same word. We shouldn't get into the idea of thinking that vipassana is something, you know, some entity, or that we're practicing vipassana. That it's, in fact, it's kind of a misnomer. I think I've said this before, and other people have as well. You don't practice vipassana; you practice mindfulness. No, vipassana is what you get out of your practice. You see things clearly, or you see things with wisdom. So we should understand that all we're doing is trying to see things clearly. We're trying to look until we can see things as they are. And this is the other word here. Yatha bhutang. Bhuta means bin or being. Bhuta means that which is or so on. Yatha means as. So in this case, as it is, it really just, yatha bhutang means as it is. This is something I use, this is a word I use, a phrase I use a lot, or we find many people, many teachers will use a lot, reminding people just to see it as it is, you know, to look at it and to see it for what it is. Because this is why we're using this mantra, this is why we have this, this is why we have this word that we say, the mantra. We're reminding ourselves, it is what it is. When you have pain, you're reminding yourselves, it is pain. So that you don't say, it is bad, it is me, it is mine. And you don't come up with all these ideas and ways out and so on. Five aggregates are consciousness, form, thinking, feeling, and perception. Not in that order, but yeah. And the four foundations are body, feelings, mind, and dhamma. Right, that's it. So how, okay, if you're asking, I guess you're implying a question, how are they the same? Rupa and body are the same. Form and body are the same. Feeling and feeling are the same, that's clear. Consciousness and mind are one. And then you have perception and thinking. But it's not really thinking. Thinking is a little bit too specific. I always say it's thoughts, in the sense of what you think about something or your projections on things. But formations is the correct one. So formations and, or mental formations and perception, recollection, or apperception, they are under Dhamma. Now, Dhamma is actually broad, and Dhamma can actually bring in the other three aggregates, or the other three Satipatthana as well. But Dhamma includes them. The point is not that they're exactly parallel. The point is that it's dealing with the same essential reality. It's not dealing with, neither one is dealing with concepts. So as you can see, it's almost an exact parallel, but you can see it's also a different presentation, and especially with the Dhamma, because the Dhamma, the Buddha, is not specifically dealing with groups of realities. He's dealing with groups of in terms of teaching. You know, he's saying, first look at the five hindrances, because they're important. And then going on to the the senses and so on. But all of that has to do with, the five aggregate, or the five hindrances are sankhara. Those are formations, so clearly it's in there. And then the senses and so on. It all relates back to the five aggregates and ultimate reality. Okay, so yatha bhutang, as I was saying, as it is, seeing things as it is, and this is why we have the meditation practice as we do, why the Buddha said when you're walking, gacchanto va gacchamiti bhajanati. When walking, he knows, I am walking. When sitting, when standing, titto va tittomhiti bhajanati. When standing, he knows, titomhi, I am standing. The Buddha actually uses a word for I am, no? And he uses first person. Of course, they don't use the word I. There's no ahang. They don't need the ahang in Pali, so it's just like basically saying standing, walking, standing, sitting, lying. Because in Pali, it's just one word. You don't just say ahang gacchami. The Buddha didn't say, think to yourself, ahang gacchami, I am going. The Buddha said, think to yourself, going, gacchami, in the sense that I am going, or it is this five aggregate, kanda panchaka, that is going, five aggregate thing. That is going. This is, if you read the Satipatthana Sutta, you can see how the Buddha encouraged this. And the other aspect of yatha bhutang is to not extrapolate. So it's not just seeing things as they are, it's only seeing things as they are and not extrapolating. And this in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha uses the words patti sati mataya, with just bare attention or bare mindfulness. Only knowing it as it is. I think this is important because you can lose this in the translation if you're not careful. Must with right understanding how it is be regarded thus. If you read that, it sounds actually quite intellectual. But it's certainly not at all intellectual. And if you read the Pali, it's perfectly not. The word regarded actually already covers it up. Should be seen thus. Because regarded, it already gets into the idea of being intellectual. But then with right understanding, yeah, it's not bad. With right understanding how it is. In fact, understanding might be a good one. If you use the word wisdom, I was going to say, the word wisdom can often be understood as being intellectual, right? So when you hear, must with right understanding how it is be regarded thus, you might think that it's just something that we study and that we think about and then we look at it and we say, yes, it's not self, and so on. But the Pali is quite exact. It says, yatha bhutang samma panyaya. And the word samma panyaya, with right understanding or proper wisdom. The question might arise, what are we talking about? What do we mean by right wisdom? And how does one develop right wisdom? The easiest way to understand wisdom is to look at the word itself, break the word up. I think I did this already for you. It's the same as the word pajjanati in the Satipatthana Sutta. Let me see here. I'll break it up here. Panya equals pa prefix plus nya dhatu. Panya equals pa plus nya. And when nya goes in front of pa, it takes another N, another nya. So you've got two nya there. But it's just pa pas nya. Nya means to know, but pa means thoroughly or directly, absolutely. So wisdom in Buddhism, or wisdom in Pali, can't have anything to do with intellectual understanding, or true wisdom doesn't have to do with intellectual understanding. It has to do with directly and seeing and knowing something in an absolute sense. If we take the word apart like this, then we can see that all it means is to look at something until you see it, until you know it thoroughly, until you see it clearly. All that wisdom means is to understand something as it is. So, rightly knowing something in an absolute sense is how you might understand sammapanyaya. But we have to translate it. We translate it as with right understanding. I think that's a good one, a good translation. But people might get thrown off on the wisdom and think that when you're sitting in meditation, some wisdom has to come to you. Suddenly you realize something. It's not really like that. It means slowly, as you practice, your mind opens up and your mind straightens out so that you're able to perceive things simply as they are. And you look at something, and rather than being attached to it or clinging to it or seeing it as me and mine, you see it simply for what it is, as something that arises and ceases. You see it arising, you see it ceasing, and you're content with that, or you exist in that knowledge. Does this mean to penetrate, such as penetrate the breath? Penetrate the breath. I know some translators use that. And I believe vipassana is said to, or vipassana, the wheat might mean to penetrate. I don't know. I guess penetrate is a good one, no? Because you're talking about getting to the core and penetrating. To penetrate in the sense of not floating. Yeah, I mean, it means penetrating. Actually, the penetration that is done is penetrating delusion. Well, penetrating and being one with is not really the same, I don't think. I mean, I'm trying to think of the word that would be used for penetrate. I think there is one. I forget what it is. Maybe someone else knows Pali better than I do. No, but the penetration that the Buddha talks about is penetration to the truth, to realization, penetration through ignorance into wisdom. So when you look at the breath normally, there's still the concept of self. There's a concept of it being me, of being mine, of it being an entity of the breath. When you penetrate, the penetration that goes on is seeing that there actually is no breath. There's only a sensation that arises and ceases, and then another sensation that arises and ceases, and the knowledge that also arises and ceases. So it's this penetrating concept. And this comes about, we'll get into it in the next section, this comes about in the development of wisdom. So let's get right on here to the next section, because I mean, you're welcome to go back if there's still questions. That's a very important passage where the Buddha says, Yata buddhang sammapanyaya dattaba. So, the next section. Evang pasang bhikkhave. Seeing this, you see the word pasang. Now he's switching to the verb pas, the root pas. But he actually, it's the same as dattabang. When a noble follower who has heard the truth, right, when a noble follower, Sutuva, Aryasavako, That's funny. It's suttava. I thought it was sutva. Suttava means one who has heard, but it may have been in the beginning sutva, and it's a grammatical mistake. It could also be suttava. Suttava means one who has heard. Oh, right, yeah, that's what it has to be. Evam pasang bhikkhave suttava arisavako. Okay, sorry, this is correct. For one who has heard thus and seen thus, so they have been instructed in this way, and you see, so learning is important. Having learned in this way, and then gone on to see in this way. The arisavako, this can be understood as being the student of the noble ones, or a noble student. Could be one who is noble, because a noble one is the one who, at the moment of attaining sotapanna, becomes released. But here it must refer, in the beginning at least, it must refer to someone who is a follower of the noble ones. Oh no, it could refer to either. Because these guys are all noble, these are Arya Savaka, because they are already noble in the sense that they have become sotapanna. And so he's telling them how to go further. How do you go further? By seeing in this way. And thereby, rupas mimpini bindati. Finding estrangement. Now, the word estrangement, I think that's a pretty poor translation, I'm sorry to say. And it may have been better about 60 years ago when he did this translation. But it's a hard one because it's hard to get your mind across. He finds estrangement. Nibindati, it actually is, I believe it's similar at least to the word nibbana. You see how it looks similar? Nibindati. Ni means just not, or given up, or un. And bind here actually means bound, I believe, or attracted to. So he becomes unattracted. And the word, the better translation that I think the same translator, Nyanamoli, uses in the Visuddhimagga, either that or it was edited, it probably was edited then, is the word disenchanted. And I think disenchanted is a lot better. Because it points to the delusion associated with bindati, with being attracted, being enchanted. We are enchanted by all of these things. We are intoxicated by them, because we think of them as permanent, satisfying, and controllable. We think of our reality as being ours, as belonging to self, as having some relation to the I. And so we get very busy with this, and we worry and concern about it, and we cling and we fuss and we crave and we chase, until we practice in this way and we realize that it's none of these things. It's not permanent, it's not satisfying, it's not controllable. And when you realize this, you become disenchanted. You lose interest in it. This is really the key. The key to the practice of insight meditation is this state of losing interest. And it comes in the meditation practice. There are, according to Visuddhimagga, there are 16 knowledges. You know, I think in the Visuddhimagga it's actually broken a little bit more up. It's not quite clear, but let's say there are 16 knowledges. And I have talked about these before, but basically it's the first ones are just getting to the point where you can see things arising and ceasing. And then from that point, starting to really appreciate what this means. If things arise and cease, then that means they're not permanent. As you see them again and again, you start to fixate on the fact that everything is vanishing, yeah. And then there there arises this conflict inside. On the one hand, wanting to cling to these things, and yet, on the other hand, seeing them arise and cease. And so there's a great amount of conflict, and there's a fight inside, until eventually one shifts and realizes that all of these things that one has been clinging to are not actually satisfying, no, not actually of any benefit. And this is called nibbidanyana. The Buddha uses this word elsewhere when he says, sabbe sankhara anicchati, all formations are impermanent. And then he says, yada panyaya pasati, when one sees this with wisdom. Sound familiar? No. It's actually just a condensation of what he's saying here. Yada panyaya pasati, when one sees this with wisdom. Atta nibindati dukhe, and therefore becomes disenchanted. Nibindati, same verb here. Dukhe, with suffering. Well, what is suffering? Suffering is the five aggregates, as we learned in the last sutta. So one becomes disenchanted with these things. Esa maggo visuddhiya. This is the path to purification. So that verse points out that what we're talking about right here is the path of purification. And that's what he's going to say next. He finds estrangement, or he becomes disenchanted with form. He becomes disenchanted with feelings. Seeing the feelings change. No. Before we thought, let's just try to get as much pleasant feeling as we can. And now you see the pleasant feelings ceasing. And you see the only good thing about them is that moment when you cling to them. And then there's followed by all this bad, when the clinging produces seeking out and suffering and stress and disappointment, and followed by unpleasant feelings that are unbearable, intolerable. And become bored of this as well, become uninterested, disenchanted, not losing your enchantment with these pleasant feelings. Sanyayapi nibindati, memories. You no longer want to think so much about past memories, realizing the craving attached to them, but also the fact that memories are impermanent, and if you're going to remember the past, or the good memories, you're also going to remember the bad memories, and so on. But losing interest and seeing that there's no substance to any of them. Sankarehi supi nibindati. Your thoughts and emotions and mental formations, mental constructs. Seeing that all of these constructs are useless. All of what makes me who I am. I am this, I am that. Seeing that they're just suffering. Just work for you to keep up appearances, no? Sankara, a good example of sankara is how we keep up appearances, pretending to be this, pretending to be that. These are all sankara, mental formations. We have all these emotions that affected. We affect certain emotions, meaning we put on a show, where we put on a we have this layer of emotion that is artificial. And we come to say that actually all of it is artificial. All of it is just constructs, the useless constructs. And vijnanam, even vijnana, even our consciousness, we come to become bored of it. We come to see that, you know, there's really nothing to it. So you get to see, you get to hear, you get to smell, you get to taste, you get to feel, you get to think. It's really like, so what? And you lose your enchantment with it. Doesn't mean becoming angry or averse to it. It just means seeing that it's useless and letting it go, letting it be. And when that happens, there's the good part. Well, when you become disenchanted, then passion fades out. What is passion fades out? It's actually not correct. Nibbindang. If you have questions about the text that we're going through, you can ask them. If it's not about what we're, if it's not at least somewhat related to what we're studying, then better to save them for the radio show tomorrow. Because tomorrow we have a radio call-in session. Same time, different place, radio.sirimangalo.org. And you can ask them there. But if it's about this, what we're studying here, then you can ask the questions. Passion fades out. I believe that's an incorrect translation. It's splitting hairs, I suppose. Nibbindang virajati. Virajati nibbindang. I don't think that's correct. Vinyanasmimpi nibbindati. Nibbindang means... It should mean, if I'm not mistaken, it means having with when he finds estrangement. That's correct. When he becomes disenchanted, then it's referring to him again. It's just splitting hairs, isn't it? But he loses passion. He becomes passionless. He becomes dispassionate. Raja, rajati comes from raga, which is in the next sentence. If you read the Pali, you learn something about Pali grammar. Because you see nibindati becoming nibindang and virajati becoming viraga. Then you have vimuchati becoming vimuttasming, vimuttamiti. You have to learn some grammar to understand really what's going on. But virajati means he becomes dispassionate. And dispassionate means he gives up his passion, right? And this way he said, passion fades out. Because when you become bored of these things, then that's the direct result. The mind becomes dispassionate, which basically means it starts to see things as they are, objectively and naturally. It means interacting as opposed to reacting. When he becomes dispassionate, viraga vimuchati, he is freed, he's liberated. What I really love about this sentence, it always gets me, it's how matter of fact and how clear it is. Because this is the most profound teaching that exists. But it's so matter of fact when people ask, you know, what is the Buddha's teaching and how difficult it is to understand. This is really all the Buddha, this paragraph is what the Buddha taught. When you see the truth, you become dispassionate. When you become dispassionate, or no, you become disenchanted. When you become disenchanted, then you become dispassionate. When you're dispassionate, you're liberated. When you're liberated, you know vimuttamiti jnanam hoti. There is the knowledge, I am liberated. So basically this is, with that you are free. When you're free, you know I'm free. That's what the Buddha is saying here. Vimuttami, I am free. Then what? Kina jati. Birth is extinguished. Birth is finished. Usitang brahmacharyang, lived is the holy life. Katang karaniyang, done. This I have a problem with. It's again his choice of the words when he says what can be done is done. It's what should be done. For sure this has to be what should be done. Because otherwise it's like, you know, you can do this if you want, or you can go and live in samsara, it really doesn't matter. It does matter. This is what should be done. He's done the duty. He's done what should be done. What is to be done, at the very least, but not what can be done. It almost sounds like he's done all he can. He couldn't do any better. But no, he's done the best. He's done what should be done. What is to be done? What is our duty to do? What we all have to do. He's done it. He or she. No. I have to excuse the use of the masculine. We are talking about a bunch of guys in the forest. Katang karaniyang. Done is what should be done. What should be done has been done. Na parang itatayati pajanati. He knows there is nothing further from here. In the sense, there is nothing further to be done here. There is no more becoming here. This is the end of suffering. There is no more work to be done. No more suffering to be experienced. No more beyond. Means he won't be born again. Then the Buddha says, no. Then the commentary says, Idam avocha bhagava. This is what the Blessed One said. Attamana panchavagya bhikkhu bhagavato bhasitang abhinandung. They didn't just approve. The word abhinandung means they were exceedingly glad. So the word approved here is an understatement. And you gotta kinda understand where I'm coming from. And we've just gone through the most profound teaching ever given up until this point. And all they could do is approve of it, like they clapped their hands or something. No, these guys were stunned. And not only stunned, but they were liberated as a result. They abhinandung, they abhi means greatly or extremely, exceedingly. It's an augment. And then nandati to delight. They were exceedingly gladdened by his speech. And then panna imasmincha vaya karanasming. While he was speaking this way, banyamane panchavagyang bhikkhu nang anupadaya asave hichittani vimuchingso. They were liberated, their minds were liberated. Chittani, their minds, vimuchingso, were liberated asavehi from the defilements or the taints. Anupadaya, without clinging. Anupadaya asavehi. This is just a standard pronouncement of the attainment of arahantship. And it's an important one because it clearly defines what we mean by arahantship. They became arahant means they had no more taints, no more greed, no more anger, no more delusion, no more clinging. Anupadaya, through not clinging. By giving up clinging or by being free from any delusion that would lead them to cling, they were freed from, their minds were freed from the taints. And therefore they became the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth arahant in the world. So at the end of this sutta there were six arahants in the world, six enlightened beings. So I think that's enough, no? Finish the sutta. Finish two suttas so far. And I'm just going to go ahead and assume that we will go on to the Adita Pariyaya Sutta as our next sutta. And that's another difficult one. These are all actually, I would consider, difficult because there's no funny stories or similes. You don't get, the Buddha said, imagine, you don't get anything like imagine a man like this or like that, or imagine something where he tries to use similes to explain it. Now this is the hardcore. So good, because it's the core of the Dhamma. So it's a core that we can then use to assess other teachings that we study. Why is this liberation considered permanent? Good question. I hope I have a good answer, and I think my good answer, and I hope it suffices, is due directly to their realization of Nibbana. And this is something I didn't mention, that what it means is that they realized Nibbana. And they realized Nibbana, technically speaking, they realized it four times. They realized it at least four times, could be many more. But their minds went into Nibbana, or there was the realization of Nibbana, which breaks apart the whole framework of reality, because Nibbana is there's no arising. There's no seeing, no hearing, no smelling, no tasting, no feeling, and no thinking. And that's the most important point, because any other wisdom that they might get, if it's unrelated to Nibbana, any other realization is still a realization based on arisen phenomena, and is still subject to change. But the realization of Nibbana actually breaks apart reality, and so it cuts down their involvement or engagement with reality. And so, rather than say that the knowledge is permanent, what it means is that they have pulled themselves out, or they have been pulled out by the realization. So there's not much left for them. There's only a small substratum of existence left. When someone becomes an arahant, it's it's the last life, no, and all that's left is this remainder, the echo of their physical and mental existence. This is Nibbana, the end of the Namarupa process. I have heard that Nibbana can be considered to be Nama. So we have to be a little bit careful there, but basically, yes, the Namarupa process ends. Yeah. No more arising of Nama, of the five aggregates. Let's be a little bit clearer, because if Nibbana is considered to be Nama, then we got a problem there. But the five aggregates, Nibbana is not one of the five aggregates. So the five aggregates cease without remainder. That's the definition of Nibbana. The arising of the five aggregates, or the five aggregates cease and arise no more. Because right now they're arising and ceasing. Nibbana is permanent, has it been so in eternity, in the sense of having always existed in the universe? Yeah, basically. Because Nibbana has no arising. So one way to look at it is that it's always been there. That's the only way something can be eternal. Is that because they heard it from the Buddha live? Is it possible for us now to realize Nibbana and be liberated permanently just by listening now? It's a lot more difficult. The Buddha outlined that there are four types of people, just as there are four types of lotus. You ever heard this story of the four types of lotus? Some lotuses are, when you see lotuses, some lotuses are already out of the water. I don't know, if you've never seen lotuses, they're a big thing in Asia. So some lotuses are out of the water, and you look at them and they're just getting ready to bloom. So all it takes is when the sun rises, they're going to bloom. right away. Some lotuses are just poking their head out of the water. And so maybe not today, but well, maybe in the afternoon or maybe tomorrow morning, you know they're going, you can be pretty sure they're going to bloom because you can already see them coming out of the water. Then there are a third type of lotus that is in the water, but you can see it coming up. And so you can also be sure that if given the time and if the weather's right and so on, if the sun keeps shining or however, then they will eventually rise to the top and bloom. And then you have a fourth type of lotus. If you look down into the bottom, at the bottom of the pool, you'll see it's just coming up a little bit, but then it's getting eaten by turtles, or it doesn't have any, it rots at the bottom. And so the Buddha said there are four types of people like this. The first type is one that simply by hearing a verse, like Sariputta and Moggallana, if you were listening to my Dhammapada talks, Sariputta and Moggallana, they heard Ye Dhamma Hetu Babava Te Sang Dhammang Tathagata Ahu. And that was enough for them to both become Sotapanna. So they were considered to be Ukatitanyu. Ukatitanyu Vipachitanyu. I'm going to mix those up. I think Ukatitanyu is the one who just has to hear the heading, the verse. And then Vipachitanyu, they have to, I could have gotten these mixed up, so one or the other, has to hear the whole discourse. So in this case, we have a whole discourse here, and then they become enlightened just from hearing it. I mean, obviously practicing as well, but it's enough just to go through it. Then the third one is Nyaya. Nyaya is probably what all of us are, hopefully. Some of us might be the fourth one, which is unfortunate. But the third type is, no, I think that's unfair. All of us, all the people here are, because we have the good intentions, you can see us cultivating goodness by listening to this. I mean, if any of you are sitting there and like laughing at what I'm saying, or maybe checking out Facebook at the same time, or I don't know, looking at naughty pictures or so, you know, whatever, then you're probably not in this. But Nyaya is the ones who, after hearing it, they take it away and practice it. And in practicing it, there's the potential to become enlightened. The fourth type of person, no matter how much they practice, no matter how much they hear, just like the spoon that can't taste the soup, they will never experience the Dhamma, because their minds are just not into it. Not in this life, anyway. So just as a coincidence, all five of them were from one category of people. Well, it's not a coincidence, it's their karma that they were brought together in this way, that the five of them went forth together in the first place, that they were so connected to the Buddha. All six of these beings were very much connected from lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. And so they attained it in that way. They're actually not exact, because Kondanya was the one who realized it first. No, he became Sotapanna. And then the other ones, one day, each one by one became Sotapanna. But Arahantship, it's said that they became enlightened altogether hearing this. But they may very well have become enlightened at different parts of the discourse, right? Some of them may have been enlightened at the beginning, some of them in the middle, some in the end. The fourth one is Paduparama. They'll only stay at the foot. They'll only get the... This is the lotus that only stays at the bottom. We have four types of lotus. And all of us are in the third category, unless some of you are listening to this and becoming Arahant. So that's all for tonight. If you have questions, we can go on, but at this point we can do the closing homage. One more question. How can one specifically discern clinging amongst the various aggregates during meditation? If I can see the arising and clinging at each one as it's happening, developing dispassion, is this the correct path leading to liberation? You have to see everything, really. You have to see objectively. So you don't have to worry specific. You don't have to specific. In fact, if you read the first sutta that we studied, and based on our study of the first sutta, we're not actually worried so much about craving, about the clinging at all, because once you understand reality for what it is, the clinging ceases. And this is also in this sutta. No, once one understands the five aggregates clearly, then they become virajati, means you give up clinging. Clinging is just another one of the aggregates. So yeah, you should see the clinging clearly, but you should see everything clearly. And by seeing everything that arises, seeing it clearly again and again and again, eventually your awareness becomes sharpened, and your sense of disenchantment, or no, your sense of the way things are becomes so sharpened that the craving is vanquished and the mind is freed. At that point, when he says virago, viraga vimuchati, vimuchati is where the mind enters into nibbana, magganyana, palanyana. And there's the cessation experience, and the mind is free, cessation of suffering. With that, there is the craving is, well, many things cease at that point, and the more it is experienced, the more cessation, or the more that is cleared out of the way, until finally all that's left is this final life. And when it's done, that's it. So, okay, let's do the back up to the top where it says preliminary homage, and we'll do it at the end as well. But we won't do the namotasa at the end. Arahang sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādin. Svākhāto bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namasāṃ. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho saṅghaṃ namāṃ. Okay, thanks for coming, everyone. And have a good night. Hope to see you all tomorrow at our radio site, radio.sirimangalo.org.